Welcome back to another episode of Chasing Heroin. I'm your host, Janine, the creator and host of the show, Chasing Heroin. After 15 years of active addiction, the last 5 years of which I was homeless and in and out of jail and ended up living in a doghouse, I thought that I would never be any different. Finally, at the age of 34, after many, many, many attempts, I was able to find lasting recovery and have been clean and sober now since January of 2015. And I am passionate about sharing with other addicts how I did it and how other people did it, and giving the hope that you do not have to die a dope fiend, because I believed that I would die a dope fiend. Familial patterns of violence, abuse, and alcoholism and addiction are so common, and they are very hard to break. And if you have believed that you're stuck in a pattern of abuse or addiction or alcoholism, I think that you'll be really inspired by today's guest. Today, I interview Brandon. I found him on TikTok. I saw a clip of him describing an assault that he was a part of that he did 7 years in prison for. And then I also found out that he was a heroin addict and he is in long-term recovery as well. And he did a methadone detox all the way out, like is completely off of it now. And I've had a few people on recently that tapered down. Brandon finished and talks about how he did that. And the hardest part of getting out of addiction, opiate addiction, is the detox and finding ways to do that. And he did it. Also, if you're someone that is not super interested in doing 12-step, Brandon also talks about his way of recovery, which is different. He didn't do 12-step, but he did have connection and community with his wife, with his friends. And at the methadone clinic that he went to the groups, he participated, he learned. And I'll be honest, I think he might be one of the first people that I've heard say, I went to the clinic and I got a lot out of it. Oh, Joey did too. Joey from the Meth and Around episode. He went to the Suboxone clinic and got so much out of it with that counselor. And so I also have people in the recovery field that listen to this show. Please know that you can make a difference. I get guests on here and they remember your name. And they say that I learned this from Barbara, my clinic counselor at the methadone clinic in Albuquerque, New Mexico, or you know, wherever, like you are making a difference. Brandon had a challenging childhood. There were absolutely patterns of abuse, alcoholism, and violence. And he went down that path as well. And what's interesting is that the clip that I saw of him describing this assault, he was not in his active addiction yet. But after going to prison and getting out and restarting his life, that's when he found himself in the throes of addiction. And just gritting his teeth, getting through it, someone that is such an example of perseverance and creating your own narrative and creating your own life and breaking familial patterns. He has a son now, and one of the things that he says that's so powerful is, I'm raising him the way that I would have wanted to be raised. And I think it's really beautiful when we can find that in ourselves and break those patterns together. So I hope you guys enjoyed the episode. Thank you so much for tuning in again, and we will see you next week. Okay, well, thank you, Brandon, so much for being on the show. I'm really happy to be able to talk to you today. I, like 12 million other people, found you through a clip on TikTok that we'll talk about later, this like infamous clip of an incident. And I saw the incident. And then when I went and looked at your page, I saw you were also in recovery. And I was like, okay, cool. Cause like, I didn't know that wasn't immediately apparent. Right. And so that's kind of like what drew me into, you know, like reaching out to you. And again, we'll get to that incident that ended up sending you to prison. How long did you went, you did how long?
I did 6 years, 8 months off of seven.
6 years, 8 months. Okay. Shit. Okay.
Off of the seven that I was sentenced to. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, you did almost all of it?
Yeah. Well, because it was a violent crime. Okay. You're supposed to serve 85%. So I ended up serving close to the, you know, full term. So
right, totally. Okay, okay. So let's back up a little bit and just start with where you're from and tell me like a little bit about your family and growing up.
So I'm from Connecticut. Growing up, we lived, I would say, lower middle class. My mom and my stepfather, and I have a brother as well. I grew up in an abusive home, for sure. It all started when I was about 3 years old. You know, getting hit with a belt, bruises on my ass. And this is when I stayed with my grandmother. And I remember to this day, from when I was 3 years old, my grandmother, I had to come downstairs and show her my bruises on my ass. And she said to my mom, she said, "This keeps going. You need to get rid of him." At the time, I'm 3 and a half, maybe, you know, but I remember that shit. And it just kept getting worse and worse. When I was about 8 years old, I was rummaging through my mom's stuff and I found a State of Connecticut like folder book, and it had my original last name, and then it had my name again, but with my stepfather's last name. So I'm like, what is that? Like, I didn't understand it. So I brought it to my mom and I asked her, and she said, "You know, I was going to wait until you got older to tell you, but your father, who you believe is your father, is not really your father. Your father is no longer with us." So fast forward a little bit there. I actually found out that he committed suicide when I was about a year and a half old. Yep. Oh. He was an alcoholic real bad. That's why my mother left him in the first place. But he went and parked his car in front of a train. And that's how he killed himself. And I also found out, this is crazy. My grandfather, who I've never met either, a few years later after that, I must have been, I don't know, 5, 6, 7. I guess he went and did the same exact thing, the same exact way. Yeah.
The guy's your dad's dad?
Yes, correct.
What is that? Crazy, what do you think that's about? That's insane. What do you think that's about?
I think suicide kind of maybe, or mental illness in that state kind of runs in their family. Because I also did some more research with my wife years later, because I told her about it. She was like, "You never tried to reach out to like his side of the family?" I said, "I never met. I don't even know where they're from." We were able to do some research and find it was his aunt, my father's aunt. And we spoke to her on the phone. You know, there was a lot of mental illness that ran in their family. So to think about it now and over the course of my life, you know, all the bad situations, those thoughts definitely are in my head too as well, because I've thought about it, you know, and I've been in bad situations where I didn't want to be on earth anymore, but I had to, you know, I had to fight through them, which I'm glad I did, because, you know, I would never want to do that. Plus, you got to have some balls to do some shit like that. It's like, there's no going back. It's not I'm going to talk about it and I'm going to go take my, you know, it's most of the time, especially for men, we just go and we do that and you won't even know, because we were just laughing and smiling with you the day before, you know?
No, that's like that's a very like violent choice to do it that way. But what's interesting to me is that I learned this actually from Matt Hahn, who you have heard of also from TikTok. He was on Ian's show, which is the podcast that Brandon was on where I saw the clip. He's the one, guys, that found the safe with the pornography in it and he turned in. He told me that there's actual research around if someone in your life commits suicide, your chances of also doing it increase if you were ever thinking of that in the first place, because it starts to feel like a possibility because you see someone did it. And so it just seems more realistic, right? Because you're like, well, they did it and it worked. Now it's like in your head. And so in that case with your dad and your grandfather, the method now was in his head too. It's like, oh, that did actually work. I guess I could do that too. But like the psychology behind that is fascinating. Like the parent doing it after the child chose to do it. And I wonder too, like, we'll never know this obviously, but I wonder too, if depending on what their relationship was like, I wonder if your grandfather felt guilty that his son did that almost felt
that's
like
what I would assume too,
to punish himself too, you know?
Yeah. It's crazy because to this day, I've never been on a train and I never will go on a train.
Dude, I don't blame you. I don't even like being on the train. You know, like if there's no train coming, but you get stopped, I'm like, I gotta like go back or go forward. I'm not trying to get smashed on this thing. That's so wild. So your stepdad, you thought was your dad until you saw that piece of paper.
So going back to the abuse, my father, my stepfather, he was 6'5". 250. I stand as a grown man right now. I'm 5'8", 180 pounds as a teenager even, but it just was always crazy. I never wanted to be home, threatened with baseball bats, being thrown through my back door in front of friends too. There's so much I could talk about in that situation, but the last straw was probably around when I was about 16. Yeah, I was about 16 going on 17. Me, my mom, and my brother had came back to the house. And, you know, there was a lot of conflict between my mom and him. At the time, too, they would always fight and argue. One time, my mom tried to set herself on fire. But we came back in, and as we come in the back door, you just hear a loud hissing sound. And my mom just turned around. She's like, stay right here. She walked into the living room. She came flying back out. She's like, get out of the house now. We ran out of the house and we took off in the car and we ended up staying at a hotel. But she told me that when she went in there, he had a propane tank on with a Zippo and he was about to try to light the whole house on fire, blow us up. But that was the last straw. And then we ended up actually moving to Florida from there.
Okay. I have a few questions. Your brother, your older brother or younger brother?
Younger.
And was he younger? So he was the guy's actual son?
He was his actual son. And he barely ever hit him.
Okay.
Ever. I was the one that always used to get my shit rocked.
Right. Okay. And how did your mom almost set herself on fire? What happened?
They were arguing one night. They were like, it was a real bad argument. She went to the stove. And she we had a gas stove, and she stuck her shirt on the stove and just lit herself on fire. And I would sit at the top of my stairs and, make sure that either he wouldn't hit her or if I had to break something up. And when she did that, I came flying down the stairs and I just like tackled her and rolled around on the ground so that it would put her out. But, she was just kind of at her wit's end with him. And she didn't get burned. But it went up her whole shirt. It burned up her whole shirt. So she was just
So a lot of volatility and yelling and trauma and violence.
Oh, my God. It was bad.
So you guys moved down to Florida. Why did she pick Florida? Do you know?
So my grandmother had moved down there previously, maybe like a year or two before. And the reason we actually left is because around – I was almost 17. I had caught a few charges too as well.
Oh, okay.
It was burglary charges, possession of weed. I started partying at a young age. I think the first time I smoked weed was when I was 12. We started smoking cigarettes as well when I was young. We used to steal them from our moms. We'd go in the woods. So anyways, back to, I caught a few cases and I ended up catching another case while I was on probation. So at that point in time, with everything that was kind of going on, and I told my mom, I said, I don't want to go to jail. She's like, and we both had the idea to like, let's get the fuck out of here. So we ended up moving down to Florida and I stayed with my grandma. We all did, me, my brother, and her.
Okay. So you were older when you guys moved. You were 17 already. You'd been in middle school and high school. So in middle school and high school-ish, what did that look like for you? Did you go to school or did you quit going at some point? What did that look like for you in school if you were already smoking weed and stuff?
So middle school, when I started smoking weed, it was like we were all a group of like kind of the outcast kids who smoked weed and liked to party and stuff. So then going into high school, ninth grade, I just felt like I didn't fit in. I didn't want to be there. I had a lot of stress going on from home, and I ended up dropping out of high school in ninth grade.
Okay. Well, that makes sense. So my original co-host when I first started the show was a therapist, and she said something that should be so obvious, but like wasn't to me and really blew my mind. If you're not physically safe in your environment at home, you can't grow in any area of your life. There has to be a foundation of safety for a kid and an adolescent for anything else to really bloom. Like that's the foundation. And of course that makes sense, obviously. But like when she said that, it kind of like blew my mind. So obviously if there was that much like volatility at home, then
oh, I never wanted to be home.
Yeah. But you're also not going to be able to thrive or like, did you play, like, was anybody signing you up for like Little League or like art class or no?
Early on? Yes. Like when I was maybe 8 years old, up to 10. And then it kind of just, I didn't stay in sports, but I still played sports around with the neighborhood kids. Like we would play basketball. Okay. We had a park. Yeah. I was still into sports. We used to ride our bikes everywhere. We used to rollerblade everywhere.
Rollerblading, yes.
As far as, we used to like, it would be summer days, 110 5 degrees out, we would be out and about on our rollerblades. Yeah,
because we're kind of close to the same age. And I remember the years that we all got rollerblades for Christmas, right? Like it was like in the 90s and everybody got rollerblades and you'd be like bombing hills when you're like five or six. But my parents made me wear the stupid, did you have to wear the, I already know the answer to this. Did your parents make you wear the stupid wrist guard that had the plastic thing here or no?
No.
Okay, right, sure.
I had them, but I never wore them.
Okay.
Like they got them as part of the like package, but.
Right, yeah, yeah. My parents would make us. And of course, we'd get around the corner and try to like take them off. But yeah, rollerblading was like the thing. It kind of came back again a little bit recently, which is like so funny to me that it like came back. Also, I have a question about Connecticut. This is random and very probably naive and stupid. So you were in Connecticut at this time, right?
When you were a kid. When I was younger?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I lived in Connecticut my whole life.
Okay. Connecticut to me is very like upscale and like rich. Is that not all of it? I mean, I can't be. It's not. Okay.
No.
All right. Okay.
Some areas, yes, it is very. Okay. You have Greenwich, Westport.
I think I'm thinking
that's
of
all
Greenwich.
Stanford, Norwalk. Yeah. That's okay. All closer okay. to the city.
Okay.
So I literally, my town, are we a city? The city of Milford. Yes, we are a city. So the city of Milford, where I live, it's in between Bridgeport. I don't know if you've heard of Bridgeport, Connecticut, and New Haven. We're in between there. So we were, you know, growing up in the 90s and early 2000s, it's very diverse, you know. And plus, we got a lot of drugs that would come from Bridgeport, from New Haven. Okay. And
Okay. I mean, I guess it shits everywhere. I guess it's obviously, that's kind of a dumb question. But I think most people picture Connecticut. You picture like Greenwich,
Ritchie,
Harvard.
Upscale.
I mean, I know Harvard's not in Connecticut, but like, you know, Ivy everywhere and you just kind of picture it. But okay. So you catch a couple of cases for like possession and that kind of thing.
Burglary. One was unlawful. I was waving a pistol around at a party. Yeah.
Where did you get a gun? How old are you? Why did you have a gun?
I was 17.
Okay. Yeah.
So
why did you have a gun on
you? We're at a party. I didn't have a gun on me.
Okay.
So friend's house, we're all partying around the same age. He left and I was in the room with another girl and everybody in the party was getting crazy. They just started smashing stuff. I knew where his mom kept her pistol. So I went into her room. I pulled it out. And I came out and I was waving it around and told everybody to get out. And people called the police. They didn't arrest me then, but they made a case. They built a case over time. They went and talked to each individual who was there.
Okay.
So that's the charge that I ended up leaving and going to Florida for.
Okay.
And yep.
So did you run on that case or did you finish what you were supposed to do? Or was there like a warrant out for that?
No, we ran. Yeah, they came with a warrant. They actually came. So I was in Florida for about a year. I started working, met some friends, partying down there. Back then it was, you know, ecstasy pills. This is early
2000.
This is before 9/11. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
No, I'm sorry. This is after 9/11.
Okay.
So it was like 2002. And I ended up, you know, hanging out down there, really not doing shit with my life. And police did their investigations. They ended up finding out that I was staying with my grandma. And they ended up issuing a warrant through Florida somehow for them to come and visit that residence. They picked me up there. I sat in the Florida jail for about a month till two detectives came down to extradite me back to Connecticut.
Wow. And they brought you back on that charge?
When I was 18 years old, yes.
Okay. So what happened when you came back? You went to jail. How did that go? How'd you plead? What ended up happening with that?
When they picked me up, it's kind of funny. They flew me back on a regular commercial jet. They had me in handcuffs. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I showed you the picture of when I was 20. So when I was 18, I looked probably like I was 15. I'm just a young kid walking through the airport, hand shackled. They tried to like cover the shackles with a coat. But they flew me back. They booked me. They charged me. I ended up getting sentenced to 10 years, suspended after 4, with 5 years probation.
Okay.
So a suspended sentence is your 4 years and then you do your probation time and this suspended sentence will be thrown away. So I technically got 4 years, which I served 2 out of.
Okay. All right. So you weren't even really out that long enough to be, so because at that time you weren't really using heavily like you did later, like when you ended up getting into heroin much later. At this time, would you have called yourself an addict or no? Just somebody partying?
Just more of a partier.
Okay.
You know, at that point in time in my life, I've done pills. I never really had an addiction. Not to say that, you know, I didn't have to wake up every day and choose to or have to get high. It was just more or less just being stupid, drinking, smoking weed, you know.
So you go and do 2 years at the age of 20 or at the age of 18?
At the age of 18. I came home when I was 20 and with all intentions to, you know, start working, get my life back on track. I came home to a halfway house. I got my GED while I was in there. I started working. I worked at a fish market making minimum wage because I didn't really have any job skills. I didn't work really previously to that except for like a pizza place. Then I started working with my uncle who was, you know, he was like a handyman. I would work with him doing siding, decking, chimneys, kitchens. So I was working with my hands. I learned a lot. I did some plumbing too as well. And I ended up getting into plumbing. So I left from working with him, got into a company. I was working there. You know, everything was good. I still was drinking and stuff. I couldn't smoke weed, but I would go out on the weekends and drink and, you know, go to parties with friends and stuff like that. So
when does the thing that happens at McDonald's happen? Because this is the clip where I saw Brandon for the first time. So you weren't out that long. How long were you out before that happened?
God, if I had to put a number on it, let's see. Not long, maybe no more than it was probably like almost a year. I was
about
out
a year. Okay.
Yep. Okay. I was able to, you know, start working. I got my own vehicle that I bought myself. You know, I was actually, even though I was still going out on the weekends and partying, I was thriving. I felt at the time.
Right.
And I met this girl and, you know, we started talking. We became boyfriend, girlfriend. After the halfway house, I was staying at my uncle's house, a different uncle, not the one I worked with. And that's when I met her. I would stay at her house occasionally, but mostly I lived at my uncle's house. And I ended up actually working with her father doing plumbing as well, doing side jobs and stuff like that. You know, I had a pretty good relationship with her father. He was a good dude, but she was very toxic. You know, I'm not perfect, obviously, but I've gotten into fights with other guys because of her. Like, for instance, one time we were at a party, we were going to play beer pong. And she decided, because the other guy had next, he's like, I had next. She took the cups. So they start arguing back and forth. And he's like, yo, you better get your girl before I hit you.
Oh,
and
my
she's,
God.
She's at the time, too. She's instigating him. She's saying, you with your gap teeth. Like, I remember this part to the teeth. Like, talking so much shit to this guy, right? I end up getting into a scrap with him. And that's not the only incident. There's a few others where it's like from her always running her mouth and, you know, acting crazy. You know, I've gotten into it with plenty of people. So that being said, one night after we were partying, we go to this McDonald's to get food. We're waiting in the drive-thru. I'm driving. She's like, what the fuck is taking so long? And starts beeping my horn.
Oh, no.
So the people in front of us are like, what the fuck are you beeping at? And it's two girls in the front that I knew about at the time while we're in the drive-thru. They're arguing back and forth. You know, they're about to fight right there in the drive-thru. So I pull her back in and I'm like, yo, chill the fuck out. We're going to get our food and get the fuck out of here. Been in this situation before with this girl. So they pull ahead and they park literally right at the end of the drive-thru. They didn't drive away. They didn't drive on the other side of the parking lot. They parked at the end and they were also out of their car. So the guy at the drive-thru asked us, he's like, is everything okay? He knew her on a first name basis because we go there all the time. Yes. And also she has been in trouble before with the law. So they park at the end. We get our food. And now, mind you, they're at the end of the drive-thru. We go to leave. I'm driving past. And all three of them are out of the car. Now I see there's a guy. You know, before I didn't know there was a guy there. I just, because there was two females that popped their head out the window. One kind of you know, came outside of the door when they were yelling back and forth. So I'm like, what the fuck? There's a dude there too. So we drive past and I'm looking in my rearview mirror. And that's when the guy threw a bottle and hit my car.
Oh, no.
So I'm like, now in my mind, I'm thinking at that time, somebody who doesn't want any problems or any beef, why are you throwing something at my car? Now I think she's about to go and fight two girls. So I end up handing her and mind you, I'm a construction worker. This is why I have tools in the back of my car. So I grabbed a wrench and I handed it to her. She flew out of that fucking car faster than I've ever seen anybody go out of a car in my life. Like, she was ready. She's a fighter. She wanted to. So I get out. As I'm running over, that's when I brandish my knife. Because the two girls were trying to, even though she had a wrench, but they were trying to jump her. I said to everybody, back the fuck up, right? It's a one-on-one, let them handle. That's when they started, all right, now they're fighting. The wrench was already dropped at that point. And I just stood there. The guy clearly sees me. The other girl clearly sees me. They're fighting. You know, it's a very fast, it happens very, very fast. Fights are not very long. Somebody within a minute later drove by behind us and yelled out the window. And I know everybody heard it because I heard it. I was not but a few feet from these people. I wasn't on the other side of the parking lot, you know, where somebody had, hey, the cops are coming. No, they were right there. Everybody was right there. So they yelled, the cops are coming. So I go over to her and I'm like, let's go. I'm yelling to her, let's go. At some point in time, that man picked up that wrench and he smacked me in my head with it.
Oh, shit.
Over the top of the two girls.
Okay. Oh, my gosh.
So as I'm pulling my girl at the time, she's my girlfriend, I'm pulling on her. I'm not running up like thinking that, you know, there's no way you can mistake that. I'm saying, let's go.
Right.
Somebody just drove by and yelled it out the window. The cops are coming or on their way.
Right. Okay.
Everybody, there's no way. No way. You can't tell me you didn't hear that. So anyways, he hits me and I know I got hit with something. I've been in plenty of fights in my life. This is not a punch. You know, I just did like one of these, like, cause it hit me right here. It split my shit open and I seen a white flash. I didn't get knocked out. But I seen a white flash, and when I came back to, my instincts told me to defend myself. So I stabbed him. I stabbed him in the side of his head here, where it penetrated his skull. It lacerated his brain. And he asked me, he said, why did you do that? He held his head, and he's like, why did you do that? At that point in time, I know I got hit with something. And I'm like, I can't, you know, stab this guy again.
Right.
And I'm like, thinking in my head, why did I do that? You just smashed me in my head with a wrench. I didn't know it was a wrench at the time. But I know I got hit with something. You know, I have the pics. Can I show pictures of that on here?
That's fine. Yeah. Some people are watching on video. Some people are listening. If you're on Spotify and YouTube, guys, he's going to hold up a picture if you're watching.
So this was the date stamp, 2006, June. And I have a close-up of it too as well.
Okay.
That's not a punch in the head.
Right. Yeah.
Clearly.
Right.
So we end up running off, getting in my car. On the way, not too far down the road, you know, out of panic, I threw the knife out the window.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
We went back to her house. I'm in full panic mode for too many reasons. You know, obviously, I just stabbed someone in his head. You know, is this guy going to live? I don't know what's going on. The police, I called a buddy of mine who was still up at the time. He actually went by the McDonald's and he said that there's like 20 cop cars there. They had it all taped off. You know, I was like, great, I'm fucked. You know, I hope they don't find out. I ended up coming to the house about 6-7 in the morning and knocking at the, I didn't even go to sleep at this time. My adrenaline was still pumping. They came to my house. I was still bleeding from my forehead. I didn't end up going to the hospital. And that's when they brought us down for questioning. They didn't arrest me at the time but come to find out, you know, this is in 2006. I don't know if they actually went to the cameras, but again, they know the manager there knew her by first name basis. And she's been in trouble before. And I'm pretty sure at some point in time, you know, a lot of the police talked to each other. They probably knew we were dating. So they figured they'd go by her house, which they came. It was just two cop cars. They just came, knocked at the door. They didn't surround the house or anything like that. They asked for me. I came down, spoke to them. They're like, okay, we're going to bring you down to the police station. So
did you admit it when they spoke to you?
No. So okay. I told her everything that happened leading up to the point of them fighting. You know, you got in a fight, you had a wrench, you hit her once. Even when she hit her initially, like the girl like went like that. So it wasn't like how I got hit, you know, and then the wrench got dropped. But I told her that everything that happened exactly that way, except minus the fact that I even had a knife on me. When we went to leave and I went to pull you off of the girl, the guy hit me in the head with something. I was able to grab it from him and I struck him back with it. That was what our initial story was.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Which I shouldn't have even talked to them in the first place, but.
Yeah, but you know, you don't know. I used to try to talk to them too in the beginning. 20. Because yeah, they're good too. Like the first time I ever got arrested, I remember the guy was like, look, Janine, I know it was late, right? It's always late. And he's like, I know you want to go home. Don't you want to go home? I want to go home. Why don't you just tell us what happened? We could all go home. And I believed him. You know what I mean? I'm like, all right. Yeah. You know what I mean? I'm like, I'll tell you. Or like whatever we think might be the story. Like I remember one time I got arrested I made a fake check. I printed a fake check and cashed it in my name and stuff. And I thought, I don't know. The guy was like, when you pulled up to the check cash place, he asked me some question and my dumbass thought that I should admit it, that it was to me, but I didn't know it was fake. Like, so I held my story about where I got in the check. I got paid for like some catering work. And so, but if I had said, I realized later, it doesn't really matter, but I'd realized later they had no evidence that I cashed it. So I could have said somebody stole my ID. But if we think we're going to outsmart them, we're not. Like I've never outsmarted a cop one time in my whole life. And it's way better to just like never say anything, which I didn't later, you know? So anyways, but I want to interject here too. The reason you're giving a lot of clarity around this is that when you ran up to the girls, because in this clip on TikTok that blew up, there was a lot of conflict and attacking of you in the comments. And one of the things that people were saying was they were accusing you of getting involved in the fight with your girl and the other girl, like you were going to go hit a chick. And so what you're saying is that like you were clearly saying, let's run, right? That's why you're emphasizing that. And I think that when he said, why did you do that? That to me sounds like he had some sort of weird, because that's a weird question, right? That's a really weird question. That sounds like a shock question because you know why I did that. We're all in a fight. So like to say, why did you do that?
That sounds like
he went into some weird shock because his brain got lacerated.
If I'm being honest too, I had to stop myself because I wanted to stab him again because I'm like, why did I do, bro, you just smashed me. Like I just showed you guys pictures of my head. Like you just smashed me on the head with a wrench. Like, me too, also, to put into perspective, if I was in that guy's shoes and he had brandished a knife, I'm going to step back and say, if I fucking attack this dude while he's doing anything, he may use this knife on me.
Right.
Like, I'm not going to do it, especially when I wasn't even, like, my intentions weren't to stab anybody. My intentions were more to scare the shit out of them, which it worked, you know, and everything snowballed. It was one thing into another, from her arguing, from me stopping, from him throwing the bottle, from him hitting me in the head, from me you know, it's just a big shitty situation that should have never happened in the first place.
Right. And everything happened so fast. Had he ever been arrested before? Did he have a record for anything?
I don't know.
Because if he threw a bottle, he's not averse to conflict, right?
Oh, I'm sure that he's probably been in shit before. I mean, what are you doing out at, and they're not even from the same town.
Oh, you don't actually know.
I don't even know the guy. But they were from a different town.
Oh, okay.
So what are you doing out at these wee hours of the morning? Obviously, you guys aren't just out for a nightly drive to go get McDonald's. I'm sure that they were probably either coming from a bar, coming from a party. They're not perfect angels. They were all outside of the car, too, like waiting for. If you got your food, what are you outside of the car for? No one's eating outside of the car, you know? So you can't paint them to be like, we went and ripped them out of the car.
So what does end up happening to him? So your friend sees like there's a bunch of cops.
Well, you know,
I think there's a delay. It took me a second for me to hear you. I'm sorry. So what did end up happening to him? He didn't die, right?
No, he didn't die. The two girls rushed him to the hospital. He stayed in the ICU for 3 days and made a full recovery. So he didn't have any life-threatening issues or anything like that. He did try to claim later on in when finally the police did talk to him, but from my lawyer, paid lawyer, he told me that he was very hard to get a hold of. He didn't want to follow up. And if you're really trying to, like, it was such a dramatic experience for you, why didn't you try to, you know, you didn't show up to court, you didn't do any of that. But, you know, when they did talk to him, he said he wanted me to do, you know, the maximum amount of whatever the charge held.
Did any of them ever get arrested?
No, they did not. The ex-girlfriend, she did. She got arrested. She was, I'm not sure what she was charged with. Probably just an assault third, which was probably dropped to a breach of peace. And she ended up getting probation.
Okay. Why didn't he get arrested for hitting you with the wrench?
I ask myself that still to this day. And I'm like, I want to press charges. I mean, I was in jail and all I could talk to was my lawyer. And I said, I have pictures and stuff. Okay. Like, if this guy is really trying to, you know, go full force at me, which he wasn't really, because he wouldn't show up. He wouldn't answer the phone for the detectives. He was very flimflam with it, which to me showed that it's like, you know that you were wrong at some point in time for striking me, you know, so. But no, he didn't end up getting arrested. The girls didn't end up getting arrested because we were shown as the aggressors because we stopped our car. When I should have, you know, my lawyer said, point blank period, you should have never stopped your car, even though they threw a bottle at your car. You're not the law. You can't take the law into your own hands. But growing up too, being at the age of 20, running the streets, I never thought calling the police was like something I should do. Like, and plus being in trouble before, I doubt that they were going to help me. And also at that time, I was on parole. Right. You know, I've been out for a year at this time.
Right.
Okay. You know, so I'm like, none of this is going to look good on me. So the thought of calling the police was, you know, and being intoxicated at the time too, being young, it's not an excuse, but I lacked education. I lacked family structure. You know, there was a lot lacking in my life. And when it was time for me to choose in those critical decisions, it didn't happen. You know, I chose the wrong. I acted out of anger.
Yeah.
Like somebody throwing a bottle at my car and hitting it. It wasn't a water bottle, mind you. It was a glass bottle. People are like, why would you throw it over a water bottle? Like, you know, at the end of the day, you know, if someone has an altercation, you know, and they're both in a car yelling back and forth and it almost comes to physical things, and then you stop your car and you chuck a bottle at somebody else's car, that's an act of violence in a sense. You know, that's a...
I agree.
You know, you're initiating, like, you shouldn't do that either. You know, again, it's something that is so stupid, that a snowball effect of just points in this story that everything shouldn't have happened regardless. But it is what it is. You know, I did my time.
So when did you, they didn't arrest you the next day. When did they come back and arrest you? How much longer was it?
So after they got the statements from us, they ended up coming about a week later. That's when they came, you know, squatted up. I still actually went to work that week. I can't remember a lot leading up to that because I was under so much stress. Like, I knew they were coming. You know, I was just at a loss of words for everything. I was just like, you know, my brain just mentally kind of tapped out there.
Yeah.
And they came. I came out of the house willingly. They put me in cuffs. They brought me down. The crazy thing, too, is they gave me a $100,000 bond. They charged me with an assault first. My mother, she recently got a settlement, so she bonded me out. She put up $7,000 for me to get bonded out. But the next day, they weren't even supposed to let me out because I had a parole violation.
Right.
So the next day I get a call from my PO and he said, Brandon, you need to turn yourself in. Obviously you violated your parole. I said, I just made bond. He's like, I don't care. You want me to send the dogs after you? He said, you need to be God. in my office by 11 a.m. Wednesday, which was like 2 days later. And if not, we're going to come get you. So I ended up going and turning myself in and I started my, because I made bond on the case. I just had to finish my parole time and then I could fight it from the street, which I did.
Okay.
They ended up sending me to a level 4 maximum security prison. And I had to go back and forth to court from there. She ended up, you know, finding another man, like maybe not even a month later, didn't answer my calls, and pretty much moved on. And yeah, I came home and going back and forth to court, nowhere to stay. I was homeless at the time because, you know, my uncle didn't want to take me back in. And I was staying with friends, different girls, hotels, and I ended up, you know, eventually copping out to 12 years suspended after 7 years served with 5 years probation for that case in 2006.
Okay. So did they charge you with the attempted murder or it stayed assault with a deadly? What was the actual charge?
So they ended up dropping it to an assault second.
Okay.
Because throughout going, they originally wanted to give me 12 years flat, the judge. My lawyer argued it down. He said we could take it to trial and you do almost have a self-defense case here. But because you left the scene, you threw the knife, you were on parole, you could possibly lose and you'll potentially get almost the max. So now I'm in a position too where I'm like, you know, like, I ended up taking the plea deal. I ended up going, doing my time, and I came home in 2012. And
did they find the knife?
Start all over again. They did. She told them where it was.
What? Your girlfriend?
Yes. She told them where it was.
Okay. So have you, has she seen any of these clips on TikTok? Have you heard from her? Because I think you're gonna.
I mean, she could say whatever she wants.
Well, she can't say anything because this is the truth.
You know, her to be protected
speech.
It
but
is
I'm
the truth.
Wondering if you've heard from her.
Exactly. No, but we all have, so my town is small and a lot of people who do follow me on TikTok also, I don't know if they still talk to her or not, but I'm sure eventually they'll get to her and she'll probably see a lot of it from the podcast or from that. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I'm not out here trying to bash her. I'm just telling my story of what happened in the situation that I was in, not only just from that incident, but for my whole life.
Your whole life.
In general. You know, she did start that fight that night. That's point blank period.
Right.
I escalated it. Sure, you could say that as well. Did she tell where the knife was and pretty much what happened the whole thing? She did. And when you're in an interrogation room like that, I don't blame her. I'm not calling her a snitch. But leading up to said situations, I can't even be mad. But the one thing that kind of did upset me is like, you never apologized or showed no remorse, even to me, when you put me in those situations, you know, and I don't need them. I don't want them. But it would have been nice to hear, even if you had made it a point to go out of your way to come and call me, contact me through social media. You could find me. It's not hard. We live in the same town. Yeah. She still lives in the same town. I don't see her, but, you know, it is what it is. I'm not out here trying to bash you or put your name in the streets, which I could.
Right.
But I don't.
Right.
Because I'm not a scumbag. So.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So you get out in 2012 and then what, because your addiction starts after that. You are not even a heroin addict yet. So after you get out in 2012, then what happens?
All initiative to get my life back together, and which I did. I started working again. I actually started talking to who is now my wife. And through mutual friends, we started talking through Facebook. We went for coffee one day. And then we stayed together ever since. But working, we started living together. So one night I was out with friends. We were drinking, having a few drinks. Joking around, I put my buddy. I came from behind and I kind of put him in a chokehold. He leaned back and just kind of like smacked my leg. But my leg twisted behind me. I injured my knee really bad. It was swollen. I couldn't walk on it. I ended up going to a doctor and they prescribed me pain medication.
Okay.
And that's where my addiction with pain meds started. I liked the feeling. I realized I didn't have to drink to get what I needed. I could just pop a couple pills. And then they stopped prescribing them to me because my leg kind of healed and got better. And I started looking for them on my own. That became a problem. It was about a year into using pills that were expensive.
Yeah.
You had to wake up, you're sick. So one day when I was looking, a friend, he's like, yeah, I got you. I'll let you know if I get anything. He was like, oh, come by and grab me. We'll, if I find something while you come, we'll smoke a little or something. He had dope on him. He was like, I got dope. I didn't want to offer it to you because I know you're really not the type to use it, but I know you're sick, which I inclined and I tried it. And I was like, wow, I only have to spend $10 for a bag as opposed to $30 for a perk 30, you know?
Right.
I was like, that's ultimately where it shifted for me. And, it just kept spiraling. I turned into a dope habit. I've never injected because in 2012, one of my best friends, he died from an OD, which we could come back to that. That's a story too, which in itself.
Okay. Tell me that story now. What happened?
So 2012, this is, obviously before I started using. He used before he went to jail. Then he got clean and he came home and he was doing good. He didn't get high anymore. He was just drinking and smoking, but he wasn't using heroin and he was an IV user. So I was with my brother at the time and he was staying at my friend's house once in a while. I'm like, dude, I'm going to go hit the gym. I'll drop you off and I'll meet you and come pick you back up. So I get to my house and I'm getting ready to go to the gym to go pick my brother back up. And he calls me frantically. He's like, dude, Joey's in the bathroom. He's bleeding out of his nose and he's not breathing. There's a needle. It was just so frantic for him. And my brother is also his childhood friend. Like, we used to sleep over each other's house. So he found him this way. So I'm like, dude, call the ambulance. Like, get off the phone with me. I went and I just jumped in my car and, I'm only a town over. I flew over and I was trying to call my brother the whole way. He wasn't answering. By the time I got there, there was the police there, an ambulance there. They wouldn't let us upstairs because they were still had my brother up there at the time with my friend. But yeah, he ended up passing because he got high alone.
Okay. So you knew that, which is why you never ended up shooting up. But so you're snorting. Correct. So you're snorting heroin the whole time. And then it ends up only being like a year and a half though, right? You don't use for that long. So what starts to happen during that year? Like, what did your girlfriend think? How were you getting money? What were you doing? Like, what does your life look like during that time?
So I was still working, but I was spending it all on dope. But I was also my connect. He would give me really good deals. So I was selling it on the side and cutting bags in half and selling it to also people that I knew. And I was losing a lot of weight. I couldn't hide it no more. Money was dwindling. I started taking it out of her account. She asked me, she was like, dude, are you getting high? Like, what are you doing? But she noticed money was missing. And she ended up getting a couple of my friends who came to my house and were like, what the fuck are you doing, Brandon? Like, what's going on? They had an intervention with me. And I had a choice in my life at that point in time to keep going down the same path. Again, I spiraled down. Life is, again, I fucked up again. I had the choice again to choose to fight back and try to better myself, which I did. I didn't do a rehab. I ended up going and getting on methadone. So it helped. I think I used once or twice, maybe. But when you're on methadone, it doesn't really do anything. I was on methadone for 3 years up until 2017. From 2014, I went up in dosage. And then I went down all the way to, I was at like 10 or 12 milligrams. I went up to 90 at one point, early on. Because they start you off kind of small, I'm sure.
I went once. I think they started me at 70 or something. Yeah, I've got some. I've tried to do it a few times.
Yeah. I ended up doing their programming there, took what I could from it. I wasn't big into going to NA meetings and AA meetings. I kind of just segregated myself and I found a hobby. I started working on cars and I kind of just stayed to myself and I knew I had an ultimate goal that I didn't want to have to wake up every day and suffice myself to having to take something to feel normal. So I had a goal. I set the goal and I went down to the 2 milligrams and I said, it's time. I went and got my last week of bottles. I was at the point where I would get monthly bottles. And I went and got my last month and I took it. And then the last week of it, I broke them in half. So I was down to like 1 milligram. And then I stopped taking it. And let me tell you, it was hell. But it was probably the first 3 months. And the doctor, I don't remember. There was this guy. He was a counselor, maybe. He said, what's going to happen, Brandon, is your body's going to go back to homeostasis state, right? That's where you're feeling, emotions. Your body's going to go back to its regular state because after taking any opiate or any drug for that matter for so long, you're used to things. Your body gets used to it being that way, your taste, your smells, and all that. But he said, your body's going to go back to homeostasis state. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's great. I'm thinking in my head. And then, you know, and then when it did, oh my God, I was lethargic. I was tired all the time. My emotions, I would cry for no reason almost, you know, just thinking about like friends that passed away. And it was a lot. But I ended up going back to the gym. It was kind of my outlet to help with that and combat it. But, you know, after time, eventually my body went back to homeostasis state all the way. And, you know, since 2017, I've been clean from anything. Opiate, opioid. 2014 is opiate and 2017 is opioids. So.
Wow. So this is another reason why I wanted to talk to you is because this is a successful methadone detox. And to be honest, I didn't even think that it was really possible. I tried twice and just ended up using again. And I bought into the whole like, you know, 12-step base, like, oh, that's not really ever going to work. And I've learned since I've been doing the show that like, that's not true, right? That's absolutely not true. And what it did was allow you to stabilize your life. Keep working. Because like I've even witnessed this with my husband. I've talked about this on the show, but he recently relapsed and he's got 4 months now. And like, that's great, but he's living the life of someone with 5 years with a car payment and a job and a wife who has like, you know, stuff that I want and I want to talk to him and blah, blah, blah. And we've got the dog and there's like a lot of pressure. And when I had 4 months, I didn't have shit. I lived in sober living. I didn't even have a car. Like my responsibilities matched my abilities at that time. And if you're in a position though, because I'd lost everything, so I could go with nothing and be sick and barely able to move and get to my part-time job. But like, if you are somewhere where you've already got a family and you've got this full-time job that you don't want to lose, methadone, the switch off, can allow you to continue stabilizing and then develop other ways to, you know, if you want to come off of the methadone later. And I've recently kind of started to see it that way. Like it might be necessary to keep that depending on like the level of activity in your life. I had zero activity in my life. I'd been living on the streets for years. There was nothing I had to take care of. Nobody needed anything from me. I didn't even have a phone, you know, like it was easy for me to get through that with just, you know, abstinence. How did you handle like aches and pains on the way down, or did you have any? Like when you would drop down, did you feel it a little bit or not really? When you would go down, like, oh, you would feel it. Okay. Mm-hmm. What would you do during that time?
You get the cold and sweats.
Okay.
I just tucked my way through it because, again, you know, I knew I had an ultimate goal and I knew that, you know, I had to do this. You know, I was ready mentally, physically. I just was ready, you know, and I urge anybody to, if you're not ready to, you know, don't do it because you don't want to go back to using. You don't want to do that. Right. It is for a crutch, you know, but you ultimately, I feel you should have a goal. You know, if you feel you're not strong enough, then maybe the Suboxone or methadone is, you know, you have to stay on it. It's so that you're not using, so that you don't possibly die, because a lot of people who are IV users, it's fentanyl now, you know, this shit's killing everybody, you know, you know, my friend died, I have so many friends that passed away even before it was mixed with fentanyl. So now it's just like way stronger and most people aren't even getting dope. It's just straight fentanyl.
Right.
But if you can't, you know, if you're not ready, I'm not the perfect person to rely on as far as my journey and my, what I found worked for me. May not work for everybody else. You know, I know that. But I took from, you know, what I've learned for recovery for myself and what worked for me. You know, if everybody could find that and what works for them, if it's going to meetings, if you need a sponsor, if, you know, I had family who I could talk to right away, anytime. Like, I felt like I wanted to go get high. Okay. I had my wife. I had good friends that would, you know, be there. So everybody.
So you did have like, yeah. So you did have support, like what somebody would maybe get in a meeting. You did have support.
Absolutely. Correct. Just without going to them. I would. So right. Through the program that I went to for methadone, they had mandatory. Yeah. NA meetings. They were mandatory. You had to do it as part of, you know, their curriculum. Okay. Which I did. I attended. Okay. I participated 100% when I was there, probably more than I should have, because sometimes when you go to those, you get the people who are just there because they have to be there. I was not one of those people. I actually, you know, shared my story. I participated. I spoke, but I did their meetings there. I didn't do any outside meetings. I didn't feel for myself. I didn't feel it was necessary. And again, not everybody's the same, you know. Everybody has their own recovery journey and what works for them.
But if you were doing their groups and you were sharing and being involved, that's what 12-step is too. So you actually were doing, right? Like, not all clinics, I think, offer groups where you want to go and you want to share. I love that they actually did. That's super helpful, and that you actually did benefit from it, because that's what they would have done in 12-step too. You share, you talk. You know, so it sounds like they were giving you like a support network there as well. Plus you had people at home, you know, that you could talk to.
Right.
I'm also wondering if, because you've done so much time, right? So you've done 9 years total. When you were in there, when you were locked up, were you pretty regimented with your routine? Like, did you work out? Did you have your thing that you did? Like, did you like your
absolutely.
Daily routines?
Always working.
Yeah. I'm wondering if, because you had that structure in your life before, that you were able to implement your own structure when you were going to the clinic. Because a lot of people don't learn that. And that's like one benefit of being institutionalized, is that you learn structure from being in the joint. And I don't know what your, if you had any affiliations or whatever, but you know, there's rules you have to follow and all that stuff, right? And that does give you some sort of structure. And then you were able to tap into that later. Do you think that serving that time was actually kind of helpful for you later?
Absolutely. You know, I applied it. You have to discipline yourself. And I learned a lot of discipline and patience being locked up, because everything is a process when you're locked up, especially when I was locked up. It's changed a lot over the years, because you can't just call anybody's cell phone. Back then, you have to write a request slip to put that landline number on your phone list, be approved for it, get back, and then you could call. Like, everything was a process, to writing a request slip to go see the doctor, waiting for chow, waiting for your commissary to come. Like, everything in there is a process, and it takes time, and you need to learn patience. And out of being in prison for all that those years, I'd learned patience, and I've learned structure, like with a workout regimen, like with doing my laundry every weekend. I apply it in the real world today. Still to this day, you know, so it did help me out a lot. And it taught me to have discipline for myself, and to be able to say no to myself, and to have patience, and just to wait for those feelings to kind of alleviate almost, you know?
Yeah, totally. That's so crazy, because I'm just thinking this, and I wasn't planning this when I asked you to come on. But I just realized, so like the whole point of my show is that I think that some of the things that we think are the worst things that ever happened to us in our life can actually turn out to be some of the best things that ever happened to us, because of the life skills that they leave us with. Like, my addiction and being homeless, that actually left me stronger, wiser, and better able to navigate life. And I've never thought before of somebody having a prison term do that for them. But I feel like I stumbled into that with you. Do you think that going, obviously you would never want to hurt that guy if you could go back in time, but do you think that serving your time, though it was awful at the time, ended up benefiting you in the long run?
I believe everything happens for a reason. And doing that time, absolutely, it benefited me, especially when I got into using. I was able to apply that later on during my own recovery, you know, for sure.
Yeah. And that's got to be why you were able to do it, you know, on your own. So What does your life look like now? So no using since 2014, mm-hmm. and then of course 17 with the opioids. How did you start to put your life back together to where it is now?
Just working, go to the gym, hang around family, friends. It's very, very basic. You know, I keep everything very basic, you know, and it can be boring at times, but yeah. my life now is great.
Yeah.
I have a son, he's 4. I'm raising him so that he doesn't grow up to then fall into the same habits or bad thought processes that I've had. I'm married. Yeah. I've been married going on 10 years. I have a great job. Yeah. It pays me well. My wife is great. She has a great job. We have nice things. I've built all this ultimately from nothing. And we didn't have TikTok back then. We didn't have even Instagram when I came home in 2012 wasn't around. I don't think, no. Because, yep, you know, for people who, you know, recently say came home from jail and they don't really, you know, as a felon, it's hard. You don't, where are you going to work? Especially if you have no work skills and you've been running and gunning for years. Social media provides a platform for people to then turn into financial, you know, benefit, which is great. You know, I didn't have that option then. I had to really grind, and I worked at the shitty jobs. I worked there. I've, you know, and it took so long of those, just keep breaking down those walls and those barriers for me to get to where I'm at today, you know?
So you said you picked up a hobby, which was cars,
yeah,
when you started going to the clinic, and then that's become your career, right? So how did that unfold? And then can you be a felon and work as a mechanic? I don't know, like, what the rules are there. Like, how did you end up getting a job and how did you learn more about cars?
Yeah, initially just started working on them as a hobby, and plus it being so expensive to fix your car anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, I started looking up YouTube videos, and I bought a few cars over the years too, little older Japanese cars. I don't have them now because, well, kids. But yeah, it was a hobby, which I'll get back into once my son gets older. But it ended up becoming a career choice. I actually went to school for auto mechanic. I graduated and, you know, started doing it full time. You know, it wasn't easy. It's not easy to just jump into fixing cars,
right,
even though I'm somewhat mechanically inclined, I would say, to a certain extent. So.
And then you were able to get a job wherever. And where can you, if somebody does have a felony record, where would you recommend them starting? So you started to say, like, if you get out and you have a record and you're starting all over, say you are, how old were you when you got out the second time?
27.
Say you could go back and tell him in the same year, but add like the platforms in. What would you say if somebody got out of jail yesterday, they happen to be listening to this show, they're 27 and they have no idea what they're going to do and they have a felony conviction? Where do you start?
I mean, you have to explore what maybe you're good at. Are you a people person? You know, you have to explore those avenues. And obviously you're not going to work at the best places right off, you know, out the gate. You might work at a Walmart. You might work at a restaurant. You're going to be doing the shitty jobs, a laborer. I would say definitely with all the different platforms out there too, you know, if you're good at rapping, if you're good at drawing, you know, there's a lot of guys in prison who can draw very well too. You know, put your stuff on the internet, try it. You know, what's the worst that's going to happen? No one's going to buy your shit. You know, at least you tried, but there's going to be some people who do. And you got to be interesting. People that are interesting, they like to, you know, follow along with. And if you have a skill, you know, exploit it to the fullest and keep pushing that narrative.
The drawing thing is so true. My sponsor's boyfriend was like in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out for a long time. And I was over at her house once and there was a drawing of her daughter, like a pencil drawing. It was so good. I was like, this is like a professional portrait. And he did it from memory. And I was like, this is amazingly good. You're right. I've actually never thought about that. But a lot of those guys can draw like really well. They've got time to practice, you know?
Right. Get into maybe tattooing. I mean, there's so many options that you do have at our fingertips. If you don't know how, there's YouTube. You could Google it. You know, you got to put the work in, and because unfortunately, yeah, nobody's totally going to hand it to you. Being an ex-drug addict, nobody's going to just hand it to you. But if you ask for help, there are people out there who are genuine and that will help you, you know. As long as you put in your best foot forward, when you're doing good, good comes.
I think you and I said that when I first called you too. And I think that that's true. Like when people see that you're doing well, other people want to help you. Cause one of my biggest fears was like, you know, I'm never going to be able to get like I wanted to own my fitness studio that my husband and I used to have. And I had no idea how we were going to get a commercial lease. I had no idea how we were going to get a commercial lease. And one of my clients with perfect credit and no record offered to co-sign the lease. I ended up not having to do that, but she was going to, you know what I mean? And like people, things like that start to open up. And like I've said before that your work ethic and the integrity that you show and the relationships Absolutely. That you make today are going to determine your future way more than your past, you know? And so that's been my experience. And I was really concerned about all that stuff. So speaking of social media and all that stuff, where can people find you? Because this is something that I know that you're getting into also now that that clip blew up. So where can everybody find you on social media?
I know. It's at almost 13 million as we speak.
And I'm so bummed you didn't already have it on the creator program. You would have made so much money.
Well, you know what? I know. I should have stopped it when I hit the 10,000, put in for the creator
and then redone
program
it.
Beta. Yeah. And then reposted
it. You didn't know.
You know, I would have made.
Yeah. Dude, you would have made like 15
Honestly,
grand.
I don't really do it. I know, but it's all good. I don't really just do it for the money. Right. You know, right. I tell my story to help others realize that no matter where you are in your life, at what point, who you've lost, you know, you could keep going, you know? So my Instagram is linked to my TikTok. I don't put my Facebook out there. I do have YouTube. I would like to start putting my own podcast out eventually. That is the plan. Also to write my own autobiography of my life, you know, more into detail probably of certain things, but that probably won't be for, you know, another year or two. It's a slow process and I have to.
Right. Yeah. So. See, because you learned it. So what's the actual handle? It's at Brandon Michael. Michael's or Michael? Is it?
I know it's Brandon Michael.
Okay. I think it's Brandon Michael. Mm-hmm. I have one last question also. You said you're raising your son in a way that you feel will make him less likely to make some of the choices that you made. What does that look like? What do you do with him that you wish somebody had done with you when you were 4?
Being able to be comfortable around me, or I just feel that energy with him, you know, giving him love, showing him mannerisms and morals. And I was never really showed that. So, you know, that's definitely big into what I put into my own son, you know?
Okay. And then, so what was the name again? I think it's Brandon Michael, right? I feel like I just looked a second ago.
So yeah, my username is Brandon Michael AAO. And, the nickname is just Brandon Michael.
Okay. And then everything is linked from your TikTok, right? Okay. Awesome.
Can't see it, but
sort of. I'll put it in the show notes too.
That works.
Well, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. I appreciate you coming on and sharing. Do you feel like you got to say everything that you wanted to say? I want to make sure that you don't. Is there anything else that you wanted to add, or do you feel like you got to say what you wanted to?
I think we pretty much hit everything.
Okay. Well, thank you again so much. I really appreciate it.